Nice and slick. I've been to that.
Thank you, Bill. Well, with my name, I could be from California or Florida. Hi, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing? I want to thank the committee for inviting me and my dear friend Pat for picking me up at the airport and being my hostess here. And, tonight was, I didn't realize, my daughter was asked to read the 12 steps, and it just choked me up that we're together at a conference. That's the first time that's happened. And, man, that was just wonderful. So I'm grateful for that, too. I was thinking about what is it that I've gotten from AA, and I've had a long time to think about it, that I enjoy the most. No, I don't mean tonight. I mean since I've been in AA. And I think it comes from the last chapter in our big book, A Vision for You, chapter 11. And I was, Bill was very like symmetry a lot. I'm surprised he didn't make 12 chapters in there. Subdivide one of the family chapters and have the to the adult children or something so that it would have come out 12, you know what I mean? Like he was so happy when the steps came out that way, so the traditions had to come out that way, and but we didn't get 12 chapters. But anyway, the chapter's title is Vision for You. And I think that's what I'm most grateful for, is the vision that I have now compared to the vision I had before I got here. Because before I got here, I couldn't see God anywhere. And now I see God everywhere. And the difference is miraculous. It makes my days just wonderful. And by a vision, I mean, what goes on in my head when I envision today or the future, and what happens when I look around and what I see. And in the years before I got here, what was going on in my head was terrifying. I hated to tune it in. And what I saw was people out to get me. And I just looked around at the world, and it was very threatening. I didn't see anything joyful about this planet. And what I learned about God in church was scary. That was the last thing I wanted to do, was to meet him. I mean, it was like, how long could I postpone the inevitable? And so today, it's just wonderful. I enjoy crowds. I mean, I like being around people. I like being in AA. But I think equally, I like being alone. I mean, I enjoy what I think about, and I enjoy what I see just with my own eyes now, just looking around wherever I go. And I'm seeing God in action. And I'm so in each person that I meet, I just see that's who I see. And as a result, people aren't as threatening as they used to be. Because we're all, as Chuck, we've been talking a lot about Chuck this weekend, we're all just God's kids. And that makes us all part of the family, and we're all the same, and we all can stop pretending. And so, to me, this is one of the great gifts that I've been given here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was thinking about the steps that sometimes, and this is, I'm talking to anybody who may be new here tonight, that sometimes you hear a different word associated with each step, like this step has to do with surrender, and this step has to do with inventory, this step has to do with humility, and this step has to do, and you try to remember all those things when you're new, and it's really hard, so I'll give you a shortcut to all of that. You can just start with one and go all the way to 12, and if they ask you what it has to do with, just tell them it has to do with God. That's what they all have to do with. That's what the plan is. And so the whole jackpot of Alcoholics Anonymous is conscious contact with the God of our understanding. And there's a great deal of difference to me. That is so different from faith in God or believing in God. That's so abstract. I mean, sure, I believe in it. I mean, everybody told me to believe in it, but I didn't have any contact. I didn't have any inside proof. I didn't know it. for sure. I just never knew it. I knew people that knew it, so I could say that. Well, I know a guy that knows it, but I don't myself know that. And that, to me, is what is the point of Alcoholics Anonymous, is to achieve that, to have this experience in steps 11 and 12, you know, the spiritual awakening, the conscious contact. And then that becomes the solution in itself. And I look at problems now, and they can come in many, many forms, but the only way I think of them is I'm too far away from God. I have allowed something to come in between me and my higher power, and as soon as I do that, I'm on my own, and as soon as I'm on my own, it's scary out there again, and you don't look like you used to. You look threatening again. And I go back to that old world, and that's what happens in sobriety. We can misdiagnose our problems. We think we have a financial problem. We think we have a relationship problem. We think we have a job problem. We think we have a health problem. But we really don't. Those are what caused the separation between me and my higher power. I started worrying about money and forgetting about God, and pretty soon I'm alone again. And now it's frightening to get up in the morning, and I'm intimidated by other people. And what AA does, it keeps reminding us of the solution. And that's why I go to, with Clancy and John and I were talking, I still go to seven meetings a week. 7 meetings a day. Wow. No, not seven a day. I have seven a week that I am comfortable in, that are part of my repertoire. If I decide I want to go to a movie on Thursday night, I just go to the movie. I just don't go to the Thursday night meeting. But if there's nothing going on, I'm there. Because that's where the transformation takes place. I know that that's where I will get re-energized, re-centered, refocused on the solution. Because I have a brain that is always wanting to tell me that I have a problem other than a spiritual problem. And as soon as I buy into that, then I'm off on that road that we all played before we got here. You know, I mean, the answer to financial problems is money. The answer to sexual problems is more sex. The answer to not feeling secure is drugs. The answer to not having enough power is getting to be the president of the company. And it was, you know, and those were what I was taught. And I just beat my head out there and came in here and found out that I had one problem, and that was I was too far away from my higher power. And didn't feel like that. It sure didn't feel like that at all. But us alcoholics ought to really think about how easy that is to believe. Because for me, alcohol became a higher power in the very literal sense. I'm talking about in the good sense. It saved me from committing suicide. And I think a lot of us feel that way, that if it hadn't been for alcohol, I don't know how long I would have lasted out there. We think of it as such a villain, but it was saving me from alcoholism, which was going to kill me. That's what sets in as soon as you sober up. You're left with alcoholism, and it's very uncomfortable. And you sit around, and you don't like life, and what you want is a drink in order to fix that problem. And sometimes we get it backwards. We think that alcohol caused all these things that happened. Not in my case. That stuff was there before I ever had my first drink. Alcohol finally set me free for the first time. It gave me the power to rise above all these problems that I had. And that's why I was willing to pay a big price to keep on drinking. Because it was doing something for me that it wasn't doing for the non-alcoholics. It wasn't setting them free. You don't talk to non-alcoholics and say, what does alcohol mean in your life? And they go, oh, it's a secret of living. That's what it is. You know? They say something like my college roommate, who I always talk about, and we were both about 50, and I asked him that question because we both started drinking together at the university in New Haven. And I thought he was sort of similar to me. And he said, well, let me think about it, you know. And he said, well, I suppose the top thing that I would say about alcohol is it makes food taste better. I'm going, what? That's the top thing you would say about alcohol? Now, I didn't say it, but I was thinking to myself, is that going down or coming up? You know? It makes it taste better. So we have a whole different relationship with alcohol than the non-alcoholics do, and as you've heard from almost every speaker, what makes us different is alcohol fixes this terrible situation that we have, that Johnny was talking so powerfully about. Him. He knew when he was this big, there's something wrong with me, I don't fit in, there's something wrong, there's something fundamentally wrong with me. What is it? And we didn't have a clue. And I didn't have a clue. Didn't have a clue at all. And yet, when we look at the AA history, I really like to look at history of AA because I see God there. You know, this thing was just a gift, but it was given to us in such a magnificent way, much against the plan that Bill Wilson had or anybody else had. And it came out just the way God wanted it, so that alcoholics would finally have a new vision. And I'm going to take about 6 minutes and just review a couple of highlights to make my point. And I heard Ray O'Keefe do this, and I've always enjoyed the way he saw this. And he starts out by saying that the story began in around 1910 in Manchester, Vermont, when a cast of characters was being assembled in their teenage years. And down from Dorset, East Dorset, Vermont, was Bill Wilson, who was attending the Manchester Academy. And up from Rhode Island, where his family, a millionaire's family, had a summer home, was Roland Hazard. And down from Albany, New York, where his father was the mayor and was a vice presidential candidate and very famous name, was Ebbie Thatcher. And the Thatchers, there's a Thatcher Park up in Albany, and that was a big family name, and they had a summer home there. And then up from Brooklyn, New York, was a doctor, Burnham, who brought his very charming, beautiful daughter named Lois. And these people met or heard of each other in that town of Manchester, and they were to play vital roles in this story that God was unfolding to lead to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the first one to be tapped on the shoulder to get this thing going was Roland Hazard. And his father had him taking over the business. He was doing fairly well, but he kept getting drunk, and it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And he had tried everything that this country had to offer. And they finally said, there's one last hope, or you're probably going to end up in an institution instead of running this multi-million dollar business. And that is to go over to see the famous psychiatrist Carl Jung in Switzerland, because he is reputed to be able to work almost miracles with people. And so he went and spent a year, and Dr. Jung was working on him to cause this personality change that we talk about in our 12 steps. And at the end of the year, he said, you understand your situation, you've never to drink again. I hope I've given you enough new perspective so that you can be comfortable in your sobriety and go on about your... Oh, thank you, Dr. Jung, I'm so happy. And he got as far as Paris, and somebody asked him the wrong question. He said, would you like a drink? Yeah, that'd be great. And so now he's drunk, and everything is awful again, and he goes back to Dr. Jung. And this is where, symbolically, we come across the sentence in our chapter 5 where it said, no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Because at that time, Dr. Jung was recognized as probably the last possible place you could go as an alcoholic. And when Roland Hazard went back and he said, "Doctor, what are we going to do?" And Dr. Young said, "There's nothing I can do for you." Now, guess how that made somebody feel when the ultimate human power said, "There's nothing I can do for you." You're going to probably surrender. I mean, you are going to feel pretty hopeless. You mean I'm going to be locked up? Yep. You're probably going to be locked up. I have heard, however, of cases like yours where people have had profound spiritual experiences and made it. And if I was you, I would go out and try and find something like that. And so he did, because he was motivated, because he had just been told there was nothing of a human nature that could possibly help you. And you see what a wonderful thing it was that Dr. Young did. Instead of taking more do-re-mi and treating him for 3 more years, he just said, "There's nothing I, the world's leading expert, can do." That's a very humble statement that was made. And it established this urgency that is so required to get into the spiritual realm. And so Roland went, and the first thing he came across, which was very popular then, was the Oxford movement. He got in that, got sober by following the spiritual principles that they had, was very excited about it, and ended up in Manchester when the number 2 character in the play was tapped on the shoulder, and that was Ebby. And Ebby's family had finally said to him, "Here's the deal, Ebby. We love you, and this is what we're going to do for you. You stay in the summer home in Manchester and never come to Albany, and we'll pay your expenses." Very loving family. And that was the situation that he was in, so he was, you know, just living it up and was getting in trouble and drove the car into the farmhouse. You all probably read that story in the AA history, and crashed through the dining room into the kitchen, and the farmer's wife said, "Wah," and he asked for a cup of coffee, you know, as if nothing had happened. And they were in a plane that made an unscheduled landing at the opening of the Manchester airport a week before it was open, and he and Bill rolled out drunk along with the drunk pilot, so he was very well known. And the last episode, he had had this moment when he said to himself, "You know, I'm not doing anything. My house is falling all apart. I got to get my act together. I'm going to paint the house." You ever do that? And you suddenly, "I'm going to do something for real." And so he runs down and buys some paint and some brushes and a ladder, and, you know, and then comes out and actually paints maybe 20 square feet and then sits down to look at it. Have a few drinks and, "Man, this house is going to look wonderful when it's all painted like that," and drinking, and some birds came by and crapped on the new paint, and that got him upset, so he got some shotguns and a couple of chairs and his bottle, sat out to guard the paint from the birds, bam, bam, with the, and the neighbors are, don't know if a war is starting or what's going on, police are back, and he's in front of the judge, and they're going to have to send him off because this town is getting on the judge's back. And he has one phone call, and he calls Roland Hazard. And Roland comes over and said, "Well, would you release him in my personal custody?" And the judge felt very comfortable. "Well, the Hazard family, you know, it'd be safe to release him there." So he did. And we all know that Roland ended up down in New York City and got sober himself, and thought about his old drinking buddy Bill, and made the call, went over, saw Bill on that Saturday morning, and started Bill into the Oxford movement. And after his next hospitalization, then Bill was off and running to go out and see Dr. Bob. And off we go with AA and this wonderful fellowship that we have. And many years later, Bill realized that he had never closed the loop with Dr. Young. And you see this series of letters in the grapevine every so often when Bill finally says, "Oh, I better write to Dr. Young and let him know what happened as a result of what he said to Roland Hazard." And so he wrote the letter. Dear Dr. Young, you may not remember Roland Hazard, but he saw you, and as a result of what you did for him and told him to do, we have this worldwide fellowship. Then went on and on about how important his role was in getting AA started. And then here comes the spiritual part that I was trying to, the reason I'm telling the story, is that in the response, Dr. Young said, "Well, I'm so glad to hear about that. I was totally unaware. I wasn't aware of what happened to Mr. Hazard. I'm so glad and I'm so happy that this, da, da, da." And he said, back then, in the 1930s, when he was seeing Roland, he said, "It wasn't safe for a psychiatrist like me to talk about spiritual things. I would have been laughed out of my profession, but things have loosened up a little bit. And now we as psychiatrists are able to talk," and we all know that he went on to really talk a lot about spirituality and symbols and just very powerful stuff. But when he was seeing Roland, he didn't feel comfortable doing that. Now that he could, and he said, "What I was trying to do back then was to cause this equivalent of a spiritual transformation, because I believe that that is what is necessary in order to recover from alcoholism." And he went on to talk in terms that I would interpret, that if one way of looking at the disease of alcoholism is that each of us had a deep longing for God, and that was what was wrong with us, and we were never comfortable, but we could never identify it as that. You could never identify that was my problem, because it doesn't feel like that. It feels like it must be money, it must be this. And besides, the world we were living in was telling us that it wasn't that. It was saying, "Oh, you got that problem? You ought to drive a Ford. That's what you ought to do. You got that problem? You ought to wear Nikes. You know, you got that problem. You don't feel, you got low self-esteem, you have this, you have that." And there was men, so we just heard all these different, but think about what fixed it. Alcohol. It was a power greater than myself that solved this problem from the inside out by causing a change in my perception of reality, which is precisely what the 12 steps are designed to do. And so I went along my story. Now, when I look at my story, you see, I see it entirely different. I see, oh my God, that's why the church didn't work, because I never established contact. That was what was missing. I was hearing stories about a higher power. I was hearing stories about this God. And then when I talked to other people, that was what. But when I drank, I experienced it. I had conscious contact with a power greater than myself, vodka. And I developed great faith in this power, just as I do in the program of AA. I knew that this was one thing that I could trust. This was the one chemical that understood me. You know what I'm saying? It knew exactly where to go when I poured it in. And it was all powerful. So I was willing to sacrifice anything to make sure that I had access to alcohol. Even after I got sober in AA and thought I was working the program, I think for the first year, at least, I had a secret $50 bill in my wallet just in case I needed a drink. I didn't tell my wife about it. I didn't tell anybody. You know, 50 bucks in 64 was a lot of dough. I mean, that was, I had this, and so I had security in that $50 bill. I really hadn't turned my life over to AA yet. I was going, meetings are great, and so is this feeling of having that money right here. Just in case, this is all crap. A guy has to look out for himself. So I got this protection back here, and that was my secret connection to alcohol. I had not cut it yet. Really hadn't surrendered. That's how powerful it was in my life. Now, when I started drinking, I didn't know I was going to be an alcoholic. I didn't know I was going to be different than the other nine guys that started that night. I just thought, I would have a drink. I just thought I would have a drink. I was 19. I wanted to be a good athlete, good student. Got very high grades in prep school. I was a captain of the track team. I was like, good boy, you know, that kind of thing. Didn't get in fights, didn't do all that. Now, I envied guys that got in fights because they had courage. I wasn't staying out of them because I was good. I just didn't want to get hurt. And so I got down to university and felt totally overpowered. The guys were coming from all over the United States, and it was my hometown. I didn't think much of it, but they all thought this was a wonderful place to come. And I felt absolutely overpowered by all these wealthy, smart, handsome people. And I just had that feeling I didn't belong, and I just spent all those hours uncomfortable. But I didn't drink. Got almost halfway through the first year. And my roommates are going, look, we drink in college. Come on. This is abnormal. No, I don't think so. But anyway, I was at this event, and I think I've told it on every story, every time I told my story. A little social event, and all you have to do is meet these other 30 guys. Just go up and go, hi, and just sort of talk. And to me, that's like, I'd rather go in with a gorilla, you know what I mean, than this, because there's 30 chances to be rejected. And I went in, I tried to get my courage up to do the best I could, and each group I went over, as I started to walk up, they all glared at me, and I could see in their eyes, they said, we have enough friends, this group is closed, try that group over there. And I said, well, actually, I wasn't going to go to you, I was going over here. And I just, pop, and never shook anybody's hand. I almost walked up to each one of those groups in the room. So I decided to do what I always do, which is leave. That's the secret way of taking care of anxiety. You just leave, and then the anxiety goes way down. It's a very simple solution. But they had a bar there. And I said to myself, well, God, the roommates say you feel good if you drink. Why don't I have a drink? I don't feel good. I ought to drink. And what the heck? So I went up and ordered a drink and drank it. And I'm waiting to feel good, and of course nothing happens, and I'm going, well, it's probably overrated. Those guys, they brag a lot. You know, give me another one. I drank it, and I'm waiting. I don't feel good. Didn't taste very good. I wasn't particularly excited about it. And so I ordered a third, and I got halfway through, put it down, and said, I'm out of here. And I turned around to leave, and that's when it happened. Those other guys were gone, and they were replaced by 30 of the friendliest guys I've ever seen in my life. They all wanted to know me. I could see them. Please join our group. We'll give anything to know you. That was what I saw in their eyes. And then I felt stronger. I was like this. And I had the sense they were lucky to know me. I mean, I was so excited that they were going to meet me. You know what I mean? That's how I now felt. I said, boy, I got a great surprise for these guys. Me! So I wasn't afraid, and I intuitively knew how to handle this situation. Hello, oh, you're from Wisconsin. Hey, Badgers, da-da-da-da-da, you know. Take alcohol away, and I'd go, hi. That was it. I didn't have anything else to say. Now, and so I saw alcohol was the missing ingredient in me. I was now operating at my potential. See, fear shut my creativity down. I couldn't be the real me. Now, I'm there. Now I'm 100%. So I just saw it as the greatest blessing. I remember going, I should have started in grammar school. This is a miracle. I can really be me all the time. You know, and it was just, I was so thrilled to just finally almost get to know me for the first time. You really are a guy who's comfortable with people. This is who you really are. And I had all kinds of spiritual feelings, and I'm getting in touch with the universe. Then I started puking, and that ended that. But there was the beginning of that. Wow, this stuff is mind expanding and all that. It was quite a, you know, for just 35 minutes of drinking, that was pretty powerful stuff. Transformed my whole life. So, just in 35 minutes, I made a decision to turn my life over to the care of alcohol. without knowing that I made that decision. I made a decision to make this more important than anything else. I made a decision that I would sacrifice everything else in my life in order to keep this. And that was in order to keep alcohol the main ingredient for me. And so my grades fell. I started getting in fights. I got arrested. I almost didn't graduate. It was just a mess. And the more trouble I got in and the more bad things happening, I would just still say to myself, so you got arrested. You think that's a big price to pay for what you're getting out of alcohol? And I would go, no way. Not even close. I'd get arrested every day in order to keep on drinking. I mean, this is my new secret weapon. And I didn't know I was making that decision. I thought all drinkers felt that way. You know, the way that I drink with guys isn't drinking fun. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I thought everybody would have died to keep on drinking. I didn't know they just had a casual relationship with this stuff. But for me, it was the central force in my life. And I didn't even know it. So I went on and joined the Marine Corps. The Korean War was going on. I eventually became a fighter pilot. I got married. One kid, then another, and then another, and then another, then another, then another. What is it, 6 and 8 years, right, Connie? Conway? Yeah. And so it's all these kids, and they're all around, and it's crowded in the kitchen, and I'm just, wow. And I'm, you know, getting promoted, and I'm hanging around with drinking guys, and there's partying. And if you were to just sort of take a quick look, you would say, this is quite a guy, you know. He's got this family. He's flying fighter planes. He got promoted to first lieutenant. He got promoted to captain. He's been over here. He's been over there. Looks pretty good, right? No. This is just about to crash. This is an illusion. And I knew it. I could feel it coming apart inside. I could feel that I was starting to collapse, that I couldn't keep this up, this illusion that everything was fine. That was the hardest thing. We ought to be given medals for the days that we got up off of that puke and blood and cleaned ourselves up and went down to work and somebody said, how you doing? Great! I mean, you remember what it took to say that? Great, great. I mean, and your body's going, emergency room, go to the emergency room. Go to the emergency room. I can't go to the emergency room. Somebody might ask me about my drinking. And we can never have that happen. I have to defend my drinking at all costs. I would die before I'd let anybody get in and get my drinking. What if they told me to not drink? Then I'd really be dead. So we stood there, all of us, wherever we were, in an office or at home or wherever, and how you doing? Great! I mean, God, what a lie that was. Great! And so that was what I was doing. I was showing up down there. Hi, guys. Hi, yeah, yeah, yeah. And getting in that plane and put on an oxygen mask. And, man, I was getting sick. And I didn't want to go up with me because I was not a good pilot. I mean, I'm in there just looking around trying to get focused on where am I, you know. You're supposed to take off. Oh, yeah, yeah. Just go. So fear is coming in, anxiety, and most of all, withdrawal. That was the mistake I was making. I talked to some of these Air Force guys. They were taking booze in the plane. I was going with this don't drink for 12 hours. You know what a setup that is. 12 hours, you're way into withdrawal. Now I'm in there, you know, I really need a drink, and I'm trying to fly. So it was very scary, and after 6 months in that shape with a lot of close calls and everything, I went to the doctor. They agreed I had a terrible problem, but nobody knew anything about alcoholism, and so that was not brought up. What are you having? Well, I'm having these sweating, my heart's speeding up, vision, I'm losing my vision. Okay, so we're going to send you down, let the doctors study you. Study this guy's loss of vision and heart palpitations. And so that was all approached from this superficial basis, you know. They're looking at symptoms. And I was studied for 2 weeks. Every day going into the doctors, every night getting drunk in Pensacola, coming in, and several of them would go, do I smell alcohol in your breath? And I'd go, yes, sir, I got real drunk last night. Oh, well, that explains why there's alcohol in your breath. If I had the smell and I hadn't been drinking, we would have had a problem. But, oh, okay, yeah, you got drunk. Yeah, you probably do smell like that. So I went through all the testing, and it was the craziest 2 weeks I've ever spent. And they're trying to, what is wrong with this man? And at the end of the time, they left it up to the psychiatrist. Psychiatrist wrote me up as having childhood fear of flying that just showed up after. In other words, I'd been suppressing it for 12 years. So I went back very quickly. I went back to Cherry Point, waited for 3 months. They took away my MOS, military occupational specialty, as a fighter pilot. Now I got to get a new one because I'm a regular officer. I have a career. So I wait and wait and wait, and they said, what would you like to get into? I said, intelligence. I remember saying, I want to be an intelligence. I'll be an intelligent analyst. I get my orders. I'm now going to become an air traffic controller. Yeah. I go to school in Glencoe, Georgia, and I make it through to school. I mean, that's the most amazing thing. Some of us, you know, here's, I'm going, I'm ready to go into a nut ward with alcoholism, and I make it through air traffic control school. And that's what I did the last year of drinking. I was over in Japan, air traffic control. I was in charge of this unit, and the top enlisted man saw me when I checked in. Captain, good to have you here. He just knew what I was the second I checked in. Good to have you here. Da-da-da. Here's your tent. Here's the da-da-da. Don't go near the radar. That was his order, you know. Because he knew if I was controlling the planes personally, they were in danger. So my job was to try and show up at work every day on my bicycle, and now I had no constraints about not drinking for 12 hours. I became a daily drinker. I drank around the clock, malnutrition. I lost 50 pounds. I was like weighing around 125. 130, couldn't eat, stopped hanging out. I wouldn't even go to happy hour with my buddies. I just stayed in the Quonset hut and drank. You know, I tried to eat soup and vodka. You know what I mean? Or juice and vodka. I couldn't eat solid food. I just was like dying in there and trying to show up every day. Hey, yeah, fine. You know, and people would go, you all right? Yeah. It was just, it was crazy. And made it out through the year somehow and came back to Quantico, Virginia, which is how I ended up in Washington, D.C., to go to a career school to become a field officer. This is high-level training. We're in these heavy-duty classrooms, little seminars, little breakout groups. I'm having a problem finding the school. I'm starting to hallucinate. I'm getting into that, which all came out later. I remember coming up to the gate one day, And then I went to drive up to the school, and it wasn't there. I went back to the gate. So where's junior school? It was up there yesterday. And, the guards are going, whoa. Captain, it's up there. No, it's not. I was just up there. So one of them came in their little car and drove me up and pointed. And I said, oh, yeah, there it is. You know, like it's back. So in that school, I finally, God took pity on me, and I had a grand mal seizure, just about bit my tongue in half, and an ambulance. I'm off to the hospital, Bethesda Naval, put up in the top of the tower there where all the good guys go and the politicians and the big shots. And what could have caused this guy's convulsion? You know, like, here we go again. What clues do we have? Well, he reeks of alcohol and this and that. They're just studying me. I don't know. Well, after 5 days without alcohol, then I went to DTs. And they were very violent, frightening DTs. I saw all his rooms moving. I was psyched out. I thought I was going to lose my mind. The CIA was trying to question me, and they kept coming in and asking me tricky questions, and then they'd move walls. They said, okay, what's out in the hallway? And then I'd name all the things, and then they'd come back and they'd say, name what's out there. And I would name it. You know, there's three telephone booths, the corpsman, the elevator, blah, blah, blah. They said, no, come out here. And I opened the door. It's a photo lab. they changed the hospital hallway into a photo lab. You know. And I went back and wrote it all down. They're trying to drive me crazy. I don't know why they're after me. And then I memorized the photo lab. And the next time I went out, it was a flight line. There were planes passing by and a tower. And so I screamed. And they came and got me in a straitjacket and put me back in the nut ward. And I was there for 6 months. And that was what they did with alcoholics, because they didn't have any. There was just crazy people. You were either crazy or not crazy, but there was no such thing as alcoholism. So I'm in there for, there was two other alcoholics, and then the rest of the people had what the rest of the people called legitimate mental illnesses. Legitimate mental illnesses. Which meant that the three drunks were like, you guys sit over there, because we're the real occupants of this nut ward. And you guys are imposters who we would be a lot happier if you weren't here bringing down the reputation of the nut ward. That was the sense that you had as an alcoholic. So the beautiful thing is that, I guess after about 4 months, AA came to the hospital. My sponsor went through the same nut ward. Funny thing is, I've had the same sponsor for almost 37 years while we're talking about sponsors. And AA was there when he was there, a year and a half before me, and then they stopped allowing them to come in. And they got a new head psychiatrist, and he determined there wasn't any alcoholics left in the Navy, so we didn't need AA anymore. And AA kept coming back, and they finally talked to this new psychiatrist. Well, all right, you can bring one meeting a week. And so that's how I got to AA. I was sitting up in the nut ward, and the corpsman came in. All drunks fall in, right face. down to the meeting. It was a great meeting. I was very excited about it. Got this guy's phone number, and I told him, if I ever run into a guy with a drinking problem, I'm going to send him in. I didn't connect for myself. I got eventually allowed to go home as an outpatient, so I drank again to watch football. I had a rule, you can't watch the Redskins unless you're drinking a beer, and I didn't want to sit there with the set off. So I had a beer, even though they said, if you ever have another beer, your career's over. What the heck, one beer. They meant to say, if you ever get drunk. They didn't mean, if you have a beer. And I kept that up for a couple of weeks, and I could see him, and I was bringing vodka into the nut ward now, because I needed it. And I saw that they were looking at me. They were looking at me, but I saw that they were looking at me. I knew they were going to catch me, and so I decided to join AA on the outside. And that's so on Pearl Harbor Day, 1964, I called Intergroup. And they had one guy down at Quantico Marine Base. And he said, we got one guy, and we'll get a hold of him, and he'll come over and see you. And he didn't come for a couple hours, and I changed my mind. I got some more booze to stay down. I called him back and said, I don't need the 12-step call. I'm okay. They said, two ladies on his way. So I said, I'll just get rid of him when he gets here. And this is my recollection. The door frame started coming off from his knocking. So I opened the door and no light came in because he filled the whole door frame. And he wasn't a wimpy little pilot. He was an infantry major, captain, and it was like, my name's Bill, this is a 12-step call. I talk, you listen, sit over there, I'm going to talk to you. I'm going to talk to your family. And he went in and they told him all these lies. He's a terrible father. I hate him. We all hate him. He's awful. He's rotten. And so he came back and he said, I can see you're an alcoholic. You need AA. We're going to an AA meeting tonight. And I said, what about leaving some literature? He said, get in the car. Get in the car. For a long time, I thought that was AA's first step, Get in the car. And we get to the meeting, and God almighty, it was a Manassas meeting. It was in the Oddfellows Hall. It's an old, stinky building with non-flushing toilets. like outhouses, and it just when you went, you had to go like this to go in the bathroom. You go, you couldn't breathe in there. It was just junk. And it was a dreadful cold December night, and it's starting to drizzle, freezing rain, and there isn't even a in the distance out there. And it's a group anniversary. Then they're having anniversaries and speakers and this big table with all this food, and it went on. The whole thing lasted like 4.5 hours. So now, at the end of that, I'm sober like 12 hours or 10 hours. So right near the end, they start a dance. They had square dancing, and guys are playing fiddles and the country dancing and all this food, and I didn't want to look at the food. No, I don't want coffee. I couldn't hold it. I just want to go home. I got some vodka stash back there. I want to get home. So I decided to run away. That's what I decided. I'm going to run away. Only it's so isolated, such a deserted area, Manassas, and we're out in the front stoop or whatever, and I'm looking at the rain, and I'm going, I better just go. Who cares where the hell I go? Let's just go. And a lady came out, an Al-Anon lady. She'd been watching me, and must have seen the look on my face. And I felt this hand on my shoulder, and I turned around, and it was just like an angelic lady who I later knew and knew her husband and everything. Her name was Betsy Lynch. And she just put her hand on my shoulder and said, "It's going to be all right. Come on back in." And I believed her. I don't know why I believed her, but I did. I just came back in. It's been all right ever since. That's a long time ago. And lots of things happened, but the biggest thing that happened was getting this new vision. And it is the most exciting thing in the world. If you're new, you think you're just going to get sober. You think your life is going to straighten out a little. You think that you got 3 or 4 problems and maybe they'll get straightened out. That's like nothing compared to what's going to happen to you. I mean, this is not some little, we're going to change a couple of things. This is major. This is huge. This is epic. When they talk, Bill writes in that 6th step, that's an epic step, that we're going to change everything there is about us. We're entirely ready to have everything there is about us, every single defect removed. So why do I want all this to happen? I'm not going to go through the steps. I'm going to just tell you what I think the purpose of these steps are. You see, there's this wonderful, loving God inside of each of us. Big Book talks about that. It's a fundamental idea. God was born inside of us, just like the idea of a friend. The problem is, we're not in touch with it. And when we're not in touch with it, it doesn't exist. And we could pass a lie detector. Have you ever had a sense that God was there? And we could go, no. And it would show that we're telling the truth. Because we never have. So to us, it's just a theory. You know, we can try to believe in it. But that isn't going to sustain us. That's like almost having a drink. That's like smelling a drink. You know what I mean? Is that enough? No. We need a lot more than just believing or just thinking about it or having faith. It's got to go beyond that. And so why can't we feel this? Because there's all these things blocking it. That's why. And they're called character defects. And it's called ego. And it's called self-centeredness. And it's called resentment. And this is a huge armor that is protecting that ego. That ego doesn't want anything to do with God. Ego is God. I'll handle my own problems. I do this. And we see the world from this self-centered perspective. And it's very frightening because that is not the center of the world. God is the center. As soon as we make that the center, everything starts looking like I was describing earlier. We just look around at this world. That's what a new pair of glasses is. It's seeing the world from a God-centered perspective. And then it looks wonderful. And what's blocking us from being able to have this view are the character defects. these instinctual drives that have gone nuts. And don't feel guilty for having the instinctual drives. They're God-given. They were given to each of you. They're born in us because they're going to give us the energy to perform as human beings, but they're not supposed to be in charge of us. They're just supposed to be supplying the energy so that we reproduce and form societies and take care of ourselves and want basic security. That's what those energies are there for. They're not there to tell us what to become and what to do. And that's why when we become dependent on a higher power, we get true independence from those freaking drives. We were never free, ever. We thought we were free, and then lust came along and said, let's stop working today, down to the massage parlor. We didn't want to go down there. That wasn't our plan. We just, okay, I'm out of here. I mean, I wasn't, you know, and we felt terrible about it. And I had a lot of moral plans I wanted to live up to, but I was trying to be moral by myself. That's not the name of the game. You get moral, you can live up to moral standards with God's help. You can't get there on your own. How could you possibly do that? How could you rise above your own ego with your own ego? I remember the first time they told me self-centeredness is my problem, I said, you're right, and I'm going to fix it. I'm going to become unself-centered. And so you can see what a joke it is to try to live with our old ideas. And so these steps simply take us down so that we can open the channel that St. Francis talks about in step 11. Make me a channel of thy peace. And this channel does not go out into the material world and bring us abundance. The channel doesn't go out there at all. It goes in where this huge source of God's love is, and then it flows out. We don't need anything. We need to give. Well, everything is backwards when you move from this material world into the spiritual world. We think we need something, and it turns out we need to give something. We're very loving, giving people. We're blocked from it. And that's what the steps do, in my judgment, just my own personal opinion, is that they work us through the blockages, which are completely neutral. We're just inventorying blockages. This channel is blocked. You're being deprived of this huge center of your very being that is trying to manifest itself in your life, and that's the frustration. That is what made us so happy, so unhappy that we couldn't get in touch with that. So if you're new, you're in for hitting the jackpot. If you will follow your sponsor's plan, if you will follow it just as it's written, and Clancy said it, we're going to take a series of steps that we don't believe in. You don't believe in them until you do it. And then they become visible. Then all the results become visible. Everything is a program of action. And sponsors set the example. This is what I do. Why don't you follow this? Do you want what I have? Here we go. This is the plan. So just don't question it. Put everything on hold. And your job is to report the results. That's your job. And you're going to be up here, not in the far distant future. Believe me, one of you tonight sitting in this darkness of alcoholism with nothing but gloom and doom, you follow this, and pretty soon it'll be your job to report. And we'll go, Joe, it's been a year now. Why don't you come on up here and tell us? And you're going to get up here and say, you're not going to believe this. I followed this stupid plan from that stupid sponsor of mine, and I hit the jackpot. God bless you all.